I want to sort of open the second session called The Business Civilization, which, as some of you may know, is a three-part series. And this is sort of the then part of that series. And what we're going to talk about is capitalism, perhaps socialism, in the next 10, 20, up to perhaps 50 years. Okay, and now what I want to do is recap a little bit for those of you who were not here what we discussed on Tuesday. And Tuesday we defined the business civilization, and at least I thought that the business civilization was something like capitalism, or the business civilization is the now phase of capitalism. It's an economic system with private ownership of the means of production. That is, we, the individuals, not the government, owns the factories, the land, and so on. And then capitalism, or the business civilization, also has distribution through the marketplace or the price system. You know. So those of us who have the most get the most. Now, my prognosis was, and it still is, that the business civilization will extinct. And I base sort of my prognosis on some of my readings, both in conservative readings, such as Schumpeter's, and radical readings, in such as Marx, and a whole host of readings sort of in between Schumpeter and Marx.
Can you tell us who the first source is?
Schumpeter?
Yeah. Spell that.
Yes. S, he's German. No, Austrian. S-C-H-U-M-P-E-T-E-R. Schumpeter. And he was, among other things, the treasurer, or whatever, national treasurer of Austria. And when he sort of saw the First World War coming, he left Austria, came to the United States, and he taught economics at Harvard. But he's a sort of well-grounded conservative economist. Now, I said there are some clues, at least, that appear to me in this sort of extinction process. And I said the first clue is the current planning stage that we're in. And we talked about the evolution of this planning stage. And the first sort of phase of it, I said, was government intervention. Okay, the government intervention to sort of stimulate economic progress. The second phase was the regulatory phase of government intervention. And then the third phase was government intervention to sort of guarantee welfare. You know, this is sort of the Employment Act of 1946, which guarantees Americans full employment, which guarantees everybody a job. You know, everybody less, perhaps 4 to 5%, because we like to think of full employment in this country as being roughly 4 to 5% unemployment. Okay, and I concluded that all of this intervention had favored the business sector, it had favored the have class, okay, and it had minimal impact on, for instance, the redistribution of income and wealth. And we talked a little bit about this, and I brought some evidence, which I'll sort of use later on to support that statement. There was a little discussion about whether or not we had, in fact, redistributed some of our income and some of our wealth, and I'll bring that up later. And then we also spent a little bit of time talking about the conservative versus the liberal radical perspective, concluding that both models, that both paradigms, saw political and economic powers coexisting, with the conservative point of view leaning towards economic power as the most important. Okay. And the liberal radical saw economic power also as being the most important, but it needed a few changes. It needed some government or some political intervention due to some inherent flaws in the economic system. Now, that's my summary, and Every once in a while I get accused of using too much jargon that people don't sort of understand what I'm talking about. And you got to remember, I've been reading this stuff for so long that to me, some of the jargon that I understand and think everybody understands, everybody doesn't understand. So I'll be happy to stop anytime and explain some of my jargon. And it is jargon. You'll all know it if I can explain it, perhaps in different terminology. So, you know, be sure you just sort of interrupt me, and I'll be more than happy to go over stuff. Is there anything else that somebody wants to add to that summary of what we did? Yes?
Oh, I just wanted to ask a question which might be more related to today. When you're talking about the extinction of capitalism, I get a little confused because that has already become extinct, say 50 years ago. We're talking about pure capitalism unregulated by government. Or are you talking about the extinction of capitalism entirely where the government would take over all primary means of production?
Yeah, that's why I guess I originally started out calling it business civilization as a phase of capitalism. By extinction, I mean, I think it's already extinct as you know, you defined it, you know, without total laissez-faire type of capitalism. I think that's already extinct. Okay. What I think will extinct is the business, is the capitalism that we know today, sort of the business civilization phase of capitalism. Is that okay? Does that get it? Any other comments, additions, or corrections? John?
You said that your assumption was based on both conservative and Marxist analysis or something. Is it possible for you to give a couple of the reasons why you think this business stage will become extinct, either the dynamics or...
Yeah, I can... what I can do, as a matter of fact, I will talk about that. You know, in other words, today's session, I will say that we have really had two of these theories or two of these paradigms explained to us many, many years ago about why business civilization will extinct. And I will present the two extremes. I will present the reasons why Marx thought it would extinct and the reasons why Schumpeter thought it would extinct. Okay, now I'll do that, so it'll be Marxian Ole Hansen and Schumpeter Ole Hansen, which is, you know, maybe to some purists they wouldn't like this, you know, but it's the only way I can understand it, given sort of the simplistic mind that I have. So let me first, yes.
Paradigm,
yes. It's a buzzword, I think. Yeah. By that, I mean sort of a model, maybe. That's another good way of using it. A model of what the future will be then. That's a good explanation of paradigm?
Yeah.
Okay. Or a satisfactory explanation of paradigm. Okay. The Marxian Ole Hansen, then, explanation, simplified. Now, the Marxian theory never dominated Western thought, okay? But that doesn't mean that we can or ever could ignore it, because we have to remember that Marx's ideas dominate or rule 3/4 of the world's population. The people that we consider to be behind the iron and the bamboo curtain and so on. Those people live under Marxian thought, so it can never, ever be ignored. And it's on Marx's prediction about the fall of capitalism that communism has really built its machinery. The house of communism really exists based on what Marx predicted about capitalism. Now, Marx said that capitalism will fall due to the falling rate of profit. And profits, you know, that's sort of what's left over for the business community after all the costs are paid. Those are profits. And profits in capitalism will fall due to competition. And by competition, I mean firms competing one with the other. Okay. And competition really is capitalism. We have to have firms competing one with the other in order for capitalism to sort of survive. Okay. It's the competitive forces that force prices down and thus profits down. Now, you know, you're going to say, hey, prices aren't falling these days. You know, we know that prices are going up. What I'm talking about are relative prices, or perhaps the rate of increase of prices would be faster if we didn't have competition. Okay. And so we talk about that as still being sort of prices decreasing and thus forcing prices down. Now, what Marx in his analysis did not foresee was the growth of the economy. And because our economy has grown so very, very rapidly, it has enabled the corporations, the business community, to keep its profits up. But you see, growth requires increased technology, and growth requires sort of environmental utilization. Now, this use of resources, this technological increase, happens very unevenly. You know what I mean by that? We discover certain technological innovations which we live on for some time, but it isn't a continuous process. We aren't always discovering new things. Okay. And because technological progress, because environmental utilization happens unevenly with respect to time, or over time, then, this causes our business cycles. That is, when we don't have a lot of technological innovation, when we don't have a lot of resource utilization, we tend to go into a period of depression. When we have a lot of technology, a lot of these resources being used up, that tends to be sort of the boom periods. Okay. Now, the depressions cause social upheavals. Social upheavals lead to changes in capitalism, and enough of these changes will destroy capitalism. And Marx sort of thought that that would happen, that things would get worse and worse and worse, and during the depths of one of these depressions, during the depths of the business cycle, we would overthrow the government and have this society that he predicted. Now, what Marx did not foresee, in addition to that growth, okay, is the fact that we came up with an ingenious invention called government intervention. It's sort of what we call in economics counter-cyclical policies. Okay. When the business cycle is down in a deep depression, we immediately kick in a machinery which has lots of government spending in it, lots of unemployment compensation, lots of ways to help the people who are out of jobs maintain and get new jobs. And that has helped us in periods of depression. We learned that in the depression of the 1930s. During the 1930s, capitalism almost died in the United States. But it didn't, because we saw that we had to do something. That's when some of you will remember we talked about John Maynard Keynes, one of the modern gods of economics, who came in and and suggested that the government needs to be used to prime the pump. You know, among his suggestions, John Maynard Keynes said, if you have so much unemployment, why don't you just, you, the government, take money and put it in tin cans and go dig it into the ground, and then provide the people with shovels to go out and dig it up. Because if you have to have shovels, you see, that means somebody's going to have to work to produce the shovels. Okay, that means somebody's going to have to get the iron, somebody's going to have to get the wood, and all of that creates jobs. Once those people producing shovels and doing the digging sort of have jobs, then they're going to have a little extra money, and they'll spend that for other things, okay, which will also sort of need jobs. Okay, so that's what we mean by counter-cyclical policies. Okay. Now, the government, in order to do all of this, needs taxes. And where capitalism survives today, it's only in those societies where sort of the government is still able to collect their taxes. Capitalism then has taken sort of two directions, and one we refer to as Scandinavian capitalism. Scandinavian capitalism has appeased the people who wanted to overthrow the bourgeoisie by massive redistribution of incomes, and the primary example of this is Norway, where they take large amounts of money away from the rich and give it to the poor. And somebody suggested that that presents incentive problems. And it does. And that's one thing we have not been able to solve yet. It's one of the nagging problems of collectivism or socialism or communism, that some of the incentive system is taken away. So that's one form of capitalism, Scandinavian capitalism. Another form is American capitalism. And in America, due to the individualism, due to the individualistic philosophy that we have, that every man can pull himself up by his own bootstraps, in a sense, we have been able to endure more. That is, our capitalism has survived with less redistribution. Hence, we have required less in the way of taxes. We may complain about our taxes and the amounts of taxes that we pay, but our tax structure is not nearly so heavy, so redistributive as the Scandinavian experience with taxes and governments and so on. Okay, so the capitalism then that survives, although it's changed very drastically from what you defined as capitalism earlier, still exists because the government is able to intervene in the process and they're able to get away with taxes. But eventually, according to Marx, it will destroy itself. And
I have a question.
Yes.
The government of Sweden and Norway are very effective in collecting taxes. They don't have a great deal of tax evasion either. I'm just wondering what you mean by that. Here it would seem to me that one of the things is that the government is not only effective at collecting taxes here, but it's effective at keeping the tax rate low enough so that it doesn't reduce that residual profit amount, so that there's something for investment. No rich man really puts his money under the mattress. He invests and gives us more jobs.
Right.
And I would think that our advantage here is not our effectiveness in collecting taxes, but the fact that we're not collecting them at the horrendous amounts or rates that Sweden and Norway are doing.
Yeah, but I mean,
in other words, too effective.
Yeah, I perhaps maintain that's because of this rugged individualism that's part of the United States, which forces us to endure more suffering. We aren't so worried in our economy about 5 or 6% unemployment. Sweden and Norway would be very worried about 5, 6, 7% unemployment, and they would then try to collect more taxes and spend it keeping those people in the labor force. We tend to think that 4, 5, 6% perhaps is not too bad, and hence we don't need as much taxes. So I don't know whether it's our astuteness at collecting taxes or the tax structure that we have that's good. I really think it's the fact that we expect less from the government than do those people. I think I also happen to think that Scandinavians are more socially oriented people. You know, socialism, collectivism, as opposed to individualism. Does that get it?
I agree with that.
Okay. Anybody? Yes.
Is Norway and Sweden, are they on the basis of deficit spending like we are? Does the government have a huge debt?
I don't know. Does anybody know? I suspect there must be some debt. We always get into this question when we when we talk about government intervention and so on. And there's a couple of ways to look at debt, and maybe I can get by with answering that. One way is to look at debt as a percent of gross national product, and by gross national product I simply mean the total dollar value of every good that we produce in this country. So if you take all the automobiles, you know, all the services, everything that we produce and multiply it by its price, then you have GNP. As a percent of GNP, our debt has decreased since the World War. In the World War, after World War II, our debt was about 130% of our GNP. So we owed more to ourselves than we produced. Okay. Today, our GNP is $2 trillion, and our debt is in the neighborhood of $750 billion. Yeah. So now there's another way of looking at debt, which conservatives will always bring up, and that is, that's the explicit debt. You know, that's the debt for which people have bond instruments to prove that the government owes the money. You know, part of this that everybody gets the bond saying that the United States government owes you a certain amount of money, and that's how we finance our debt. There is another way called implicit debt. You know, and that's perhaps the debt we ought to be concerned about. Because how many of you have a debt instrument telling you that the government owes you Social Security when you retire? How many? Not very many. Do we expect it?
We trust it.
Yeah, we trust and we expect it. Now that debt, nobody knows the magnitude of that debt, but we know it's around $3 to $5 trillion. You know, and you say, you know, $3 to $5 trillion. You know, those are rough estimates, but that's about as close as we can come, depending on those numbers. Are really what I call it, and I've read it elsewhere. You know, mago numbers. My eyes gloss right over the numbers. They are so big they don't mean a thing to us. I don't even know how many zeros on trillion. Yeah. How many of you know how many zeros on trillion? 1 trillion? 9, 12, I don't know. 12? It's a big number. It's a big number. Yes?
Might not another reason for the ability of this country to exist without the kind of redistribution of income and wealth that the Scandinavian and other countries have experienced be because we have had the reality and the myth of always upward mobility, that there's always a safety valve. We began and we've continued with the frontier mentality and the individualism and the opportunities for individuals being told from birth that anyone can be a millionaire or a president.
That's right.
So there hasn't been a history of organizing collectively to fight for things from the government or the takeover of the government or the economy. That it's been instilled into us from birth that we can do it individually, and that there are always those safety valves in our society that allow for that kind of pressure.
Absolutely. Yeah. Couldn't agree with you more. The American dream. Everybody becomes president of a corporation. Can't happen to everybody, but you're right.
I heard the other day there's about 1 millionaire for every 400 people in the United States.
Somebody else told me that.
I heard that same figure on the radio.
Did you?
Within the last week. Yeah.
Divide 400 into 225 million. And you get some horrendously large number like 4 into 5, 2, that's what?
No,
it's almost 400,000 millionaires in this country. That sounds like 200,000 millionaires. I don't know if that's true or not. That's entirely
that depends on
well, paper millionaire, I think this day, you know, 10 years ago, if you knew a real estate agent and he had on his business card member of $1 million a year sales, he was good. He did a good job.
Yeah.
Nowadays, at least in California, that means the guy sold a house a month. An individual who can go out and has, over the last 15 years, has bought up a few houses for rentals or small apartment houses, duplexes, if he owns 6 or 7 houses, could be called a millionaire.
Yeah.
He can show on paper that he has $1 million in assets.
That's right. And that's a good point.
And so, those farmers.
Yeah,
so it's probably realistic. Prices have increased over 100% just in the last 10 years anyway.
Sure. So it's pretty easy to believe those kind of statistics now.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up. My doubt has been removed.
Back to the debt issue for a minute. How fair is it to link inflation closely with national debt? And also, what do you see as the impact of inflation, the worldwide kind of inflation spiral we're experiencing now? What's the impact of that going to be on the kind of erosion of the business civilization you're talking about?
Could I defer that?
No.
And come back to it a little bit later?
Okay. Well, do the debt and the inflation thing correlate at this point, or you want
to? Oh, to some extent, but not as much as we believe. There is a...
I guess my question is, are the people who are saying balance the national budget and we'll wipe out inflation, are they way off base?
Yeah, I think so. See, people are that want to wipe out the national debt. What they're really thinking is that the government, when they borrow money, go into the marketplace. You know, the government borrows from exactly the same places that business corporations borrow from. You know, when they need to spend more money, when they need to have deficit spending, and the feeling is that the government, because of its priority and its ability to pay the interest rate without having to worry about that affecting profits, will crowd out the business sector. When you crowd out the business sector, you don't get investment. When you don't get investment, you don't get production and you don't get jobs and so on. And in this way, then, that means we're going to have more people on welfare. More people on welfare means government has to have more money, and that feeds inflation in that respect. There has been no evidence that the business sector has been crowded out. You know, investment has... There are other reasons why the level of investment is not as high as we'd like to have it, which probably explain more than that crowding out thesis. Okay? Any other comments? Okay, I want to then get back to my agenda and let my agenda interfere in sort of the discussion process here. But I promised I'd also present Schumpeter's more conservative view of why capitalism will destroy itself. And Schumpeter simply said that capitalism will destroy itself due to its own success. The success of capitalism, Schumpeter said, would create a manager class, a managerial class, which would rival, in a way, the ownership class or the capitalist class. And this manager class, or management class, in order to protect itself, needed to take fewer and lesser risks. If you're fired from your job as a corporate president, if you do not produce a profit. Okay. Now, how are you going to produce a profit? Well, you're going to bet on things where the risks are less. Okay. So you're going to take only the safe bets. Now, that's not what the original entrepreneurs, you know, that's not what John D. Rockefeller did, the rest of the robber barons. They took tremendous risks, made large amounts of money. But the manager class will not do this. They want to reduce their risk-taking as much as they possibly can. And to reduce risks, they will hire a great big class of sub-managers to do work for them, such as marketing research to analyze business conditions. If you have a good handle on what the business conditions will be like, okay, that's going to sort of reduce your risk when you invest. You're going to have more and better information. So managers, then the manager class will hire a group of people that will do research for them to enable them to predict the business conditions better. But if you're going to do this kind of work, this sub-management class that's been created will need data. And the data needs collection agencies, and in large part, those collection agencies will be government. So now you have then, as a result of this less risk-taking, a large management class created, which needs and creates a large bureaucracy, a large government class, and it is this class then which will begin to rule things. Okay, this class, in order to become more efficient, will have to do more planning, and hence more planning, more collectivism. We slide then from capitalism into socialism. Is that clear enough?
No. Why are we sliding to socialism now? I missed something.
Okay, we slide to socialism, Schumpeter says, because managers create a class of sub-managers.
Yeah.
Sub-managers need sort of data collectors and government to help them perform their function. The performance of this function, which is largely done by governments, creates a tremendous bureaucracy, you know, the government, and you can see the expansion of government growth. Large classes of bureaucrats are cropping up all the time. Okay.
What would be a concrete example of that, Jan? Department of Agriculture?
Department of Agriculture, Department of Labor, Manpower Development, Manpower Administration. Those are relatively new government bureaucracies that we have not had, and they put out a tremendous amount of data. And there is a continual hue and cry for more and better data, which require more management. In addition to that, you see, you also need a bureaucracy in a way to regulate. Okay? And so all the regulatory agencies then fit in, because the sub-managers want to protect their fiefdom in a way. And so they're going to want government to help them protect that which they have.
Is the premise then that the government or the managing class has developed the government bureaucracy?
Yeah, that's what Schumpeter would say. Or maybe they helped create each other, you know, in a way. But it started in the economic sector. It started in the business sector.
Okay. Striving for the government agency to control it?
Well, that is sort of another phase of it. The thereafter phase of it. You know, when the government sort of becomes the dominant force. Okay, that's when I really think capitalism will extinct. You know, when the political power becomes more powerful than the economic power segment. I still don't think we'll reach that stage in 30, 40, 50 years. You know, I don't think anybody could ever be precise about when that will happen. But in this sort of intermediate period that we're talking about, I still think economic power, that is the business sector, will still dominate. So economic power dominates over political power. And then in another phase, I think political power dominates over economic power, and that's when we lose capitalism completely.
Well, this isn't going to happen all of a sudden.
No.
Because we've gone and been doing that for the last, well, maybe 100 years, going away from capitalism towards more government control, more government intervention all the time.
It may not be a negative thing. It's not like the extinction of an animal or a creature that we have no more. It might be a better bird or if I were a better animal or whatever.
How many of you would lament the slide from feudalism into industrial, through the Industrial Revolution?
Only if I were a feudal lord.
Okay. How many capitalists are there?
I, like most people living at this time, of course, you have mixed emotions about this, but I think of one negative aspect, and that's the elimination of the diversity of power groupings, that we are more and more putting power into the hands of fewer and fewer, say, bureaucrats. If you lump bureaucrats and the management class all together, at least we have two separate groups there, each having separate power over our lives, political and economic. And your thesis is that we are creating a large amount of economic power all consolidated under the government, awaiting the day that a person comes into office, say a dynamic president, who will not only have vast political power, but economic power over our lives, so that we may not choose to vote for him, but at the same time he can squeeze us in other ways. I would think that would be a frighteningly negative aspect of it. The very thing that might destroy the essence of the United States Constitution.
Yeah, go ahead, Brad, and then behind you.
Can you offer just a brief assessment of what you see going on in Great Britain right now? Is this a reversal process from a socialist thinking toward capitalism, or how? I mean, is this change in government going to be as dynamic as some people want to think?
You're always
locked in.
Yeah. With respect to time, okay, in Britain, perhaps you're seeing sort of more capitalism and less collectivism or something like that. And so we're sort of seeing an aberration, an unusual kind of bump in the curve, that is we're getting more capitalism. But the secular or the long-term trend is for that sort of bumpy curve to go down. In other words, this is just a little short phase where capitalism is spurting, and then eventually it'll drop down further than it was before. Is that? Get it? Okay. So I don't think it's significant in the long run. It is in the short run. Yeah, back there, and then you can make.
Go ahead. I'm not so sure it's a resurgence of capitalism. In the United States, during the last election, we had a movement to a conservative posture in government. In Canada, Trudeau has been put out, and that's a more conservative approach from somebody from Alberta. In London or in England, you had the same situation. I'm not so sure. I think it's almost a case of age. Our populations for all three countries have become older, and we have different expectations than we did 10 or 15 years ago. And we've had a mass increase in bureaucracy in all the countries since World War II. There's kind of a leveling off period, it seems to me, that says let's catch our breath and see where we're going. And
well, that's perhaps true. But how long do we sort of stay on that plateau before we dip down again, see? And then I think you're right, but I also equate conservatism with capitalism, see? So whatever, when something turns more conservative, I think it also turns more capitalistic.
Generally, I guess I agree with that. I have one question. Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I have a question that goes to the management class and to the larger bureaucracy. Both are made up of basically, although upper middle class and middle class, a very vast grouping of people that will, and I think, will be dominated more by self-interest, not only in business, but also in government. You have the FCC fighting with somebody else, and there'll be countervailing powers to a certain extent. So even though we don't have the same traditional kinds of powers that we had during capitalism, we might very well have just as effective countervailing powers in this new system if and when it develops.
Yeah, perhaps even better, because yes, there's more concentration in those large groups. We've had splinters of groups, you know, FCC fighting ICC, sure, and so on. And then perhaps later on they'll join forces and we'll have much more of what Galbraith called countervailing power. Bigness fighting bigness, that's really what countervailing powers is. The individual can no longer fight for himself, so he bands together in a union, okay? And the union, in its bigness, can stand up to the corporation in its bigness, you know, and we get sort of competition in that way. I don't know how effective that would be. There's perhaps a tendency for the two biggies to align themselves, you know, and maybe that would be...
Just the first a possibility and then a two-part question. It seems that the movement towards more conservative governments in Britain and the defeat of the communists, rise in power in Italy, and the change in government in Canada and so forth might be an indication of the willingness of people to submit to an authoritarian kind of, a more authoritarian kind of government, as Heilbronn was talking about in the book he suggested on Tuesday, when faced with the kinds of chaos and disorder and seemingly unmanageable situations that face us, and that we revert back to a childlike kind of obedience to a larger figure, and that happens all the way up the line, that even the authoritarian leaders most often appeal to a higher source of authority, whether a voice that they can hear themselves or God or something. And the question is, where do you see the transnational corporations fitting in to this move towards a more collectivist design of society, whether they would be in equal partnership with the government, or if it might be that the government would be the subordinate arm of the transnationals, that they now have more assets and more power than so many countries around the world as it is. And also, if the new class that Irving Kristol talks about in his book, Two Chairs for Capitalism, is synonymous with your description of this managerial, bureaucratic, data-gathering class that is moving into a greater position of authority.
Okay, I'm not sure I understood your second question, but let me try to answer the first one, and then I'll ask you about the second one. There are perhaps two clear, perhaps three, can I call them things, that can happen with respect to the multinational corporation. And one is that will become the dominant force, that multinational corporations will transcend and take over nation states and rule the world based then on large trade corporations. And the second is that nation states will rule. That is, nationalism, patriotism, and that sort of stuff will rule. In the short run, I think nationalism, patriotism will rule, and that we will eventually find a way, or that we will find a way in the short run to control the multinational corporation. Perhaps not necessarily through something like a world court or a world legal system, but we'll make treaties, we'll patch here and there, you know, bilaterally or trilaterally, you know, in an attempt to control the multinational corporation. So I think we'll still retain national boundaries, nationalism will prevail, at least in this short-run period. But that's a tremendously important question, and it's one of the ones that will have to be answered before we can talk about what post-industrial capitalism or what the future will be. That's one that clearly has to be answered. The second part of your question, I didn't understand.
Kristol talks about, when he identifies a new class, in capital letters as being composed of what sounds to me like pretty much the same group of people that you're describing as the sub-managers and the bureaucrats and the data collectors. He refers to the bureaucrats in the ever-growing number of bureaucracies and to the people in the ever-growing communications industry and the people in education, lumps them all together and says that they are essentially the enemies of a business-oriented capitalism, that their interests are not aligned with the interests of the profit motive and free enterprise. And I'm wondering if you're familiar with that new class and if you see those as being the same, or is that, or am I making...
No, I guess I would agree with you that it's probably the same. I'm not familiar with that part of Crystal's writing, but I think, based on what you said, that it's probably the same thing. And I do have some comments about that later on, if we get that far. But we shouldn't let sort of my agenda interfere with the discussion.
A factor that seems to me to be important, but I'm not sure economists put it as important, unlimited resources, natural resources, or at least the assumption of them, seems to me to be so important in the last 100 years. Low cost of oil, that the capitalist did not have to pay for water or the polluting, there were no social costs. Is that not, that we've come to a kind of asking the question of what could be a sustainable society, environmental impact, and limited resources. Does that not change the possibility of huge profits and all that?
Yes, yeah, very definitely. And I think it's, again, part of my agenda down the line. But I think that's probably when maybe some kind of authoritarian political force begins to rule over economic forces. When we've reached that stage where we recognize this, I don't think we've gotten to the stage where we recognize the finiteness of our resources yet. We still think it's abundant, but when we reach that stage, yep, that's when I think political power will begin to exert its influence over economic power, and it's really important.
I have a question. What is political force that we talk about?
Government.
But have trouble with that.
Authoritarian
agencies?
No, the government
only responds basically to what they think the people want.
Well, I sort of tend to think that the kind of governmental or political force that I'm talking about is one that becomes more dominated by a few. It tends to develop a structure of its own, controlling all its own smaller structures. And some one at, I'm not sure whether there's going to be one person at the head of the government controlling everything, but there's going to be decisions made by fewer and fewer people, you know, and that kind of political force. Almost authoritarian. I think in the end, it's going to be authoritarian. And I also think in the end, we're going to recognize the need, you know, for something like that, and we're actually going to like it. Or at least we're not going to object to it.
One of the theories that backs up what you're saying, Dan, what the gentleman back there is saying, is that the middle class undergirds, to a great extent, many of the totalitarian societies, such as in Hitler's Germany. And you find many middle class people today saying, why doesn't the government do something about energy? Primarily because the middle class stands to lose the most. Many of us have experienced, to some degree, having less than what we have affluently at the moment. And we certainly don't want to have less. In fact, we'd have to like to have a little more before we run our lot in this life. And when it maybe came down to making choices, I'm not so sure if I would reject more authoritarianism in government. I'm not saying that I would go for it. I'm not so sure. I can sit here and say I would reject it if the other alternative was slipping further into poverty individually.
Yeah, and maybe that answers your question better. I think so too. I would.
I'd like to discuss, get back to this management class slipping into relying on the government for database. I guess I see it going the other way right now, the last few years, and the trend seems to be that way, and that for one thing, businessmen, I think, are finding that the data that's gathered by the government is too late. You know, they'll tell us 2 years from now, yes, you had a recession, etc. Okay. And we all know to where you can get, if you're really doing market surveys and business planning, you can get privately published data. But it will probably be just as accurate, and you can get it much faster when it'll do you some good. The other thing is the general, kind of tax revolt. But people are getting dissatisfied with the bureaucracy in general. Whether it's the actual controlling regulatory agencies or the welfare, or the general dissatisfaction and distrust of school districts. In California right now, school teachers have got a bad name.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, it's not the teacher's fault, it's the administrator's fault, I think. But this whole thing that we've gone through in California with the Proposition 13 and supposed laying off of millions of people, and yeah, there were some layoffs. Probably not in the right place. And the fact that I think a lot of people in business view the bureaucracy of being so cumbersome that it can't accomplish anything.
Yeah, but I have yet to see a good private research institution do anything without relying on government data. You need the government, even though private institutions are cropping up. See, they're just slipping into spots where government doesn't function, but they use government data to do it. So I wouldn't agree with you on that part.
There's also some trend, I feel, that business is, particularly the smaller to medium-sized business, is rejecting some of this government intervention in the form of a small manufacturing company is required to fill out this several horrendous documents, multi-page documents, and you have to go back through all your accounting books and procedures, and you spend many, many man hours doing this. And there's beginning to be a revolt.
Well, except, yeah.
There's a revolt against that, but that came as a response, it seems. And the bureaucrats made up the forms, no question about that. But they made up the forms in response to Congress or the President setting up an agency or some kind of commission to take care of a problem that was perceived. Probably too late, I agree with you. 2 to 3 years after the fact, we get the agency or the commission. Rarely do we get it when we think it would do the most good. But that, I think, also goes because the middle class, and I tend to agree that the middle class is the foundation of government and business, is not ready to respond. We don't respond to major needs until we start perceiving it all around us. And then we start, okay, then we'll answer it. But that's usually well after the time that it needed a solution.
I don't think really government is to the point yet where they create agencies to create forms unless the people ask for them. So that for everyone that complains about a form, there are probably five that have asked in some way to have that form made up. And so
maybe we need to go through an evolution of this kind of thing for the next 20 years before the forms are at the point where it can be understood and used more.
There was an effort not too long ago to simplify the forms, and just the forms that came out of that effort was something like 20,000 pages.
Paper created to reduce that.
I sometimes wonder if some of the things, like you're talking about Proposition 13 and other many rebellions were not just flare-ups, as you were saying, on a downward trend. Even the environmental movement, as much as most of us support it. I live in the Puget Sound area, and I recall when I first moved to that area about 15 years ago, the Union Oil Company was asking for permission to put undersea rigs, test rigs, to find out if there's oil underneath the sound. And it was rejected by the state government. And I remember myself thinking, gee, I'm glad that didn't happen. But now, in the course of 15 years, I'm wondering if our concern for the environment and aesthetics would be as important today if Union Oil came back and said, we think there's oil underneath that sound.
Yeah.
And that when it comes to the real crunch times, that some of these many rebellions will be nothing more than that, sidelights in history, because we will have to be focusing on life and death, so to speak, situations, as compared to aesthetics and things we would like to have.
Yeah. Yeah. And how many Proposition 13s have passed? One. I know of three that have failed. I can't think, Michigan, Oregon, and I can't think of the third one. But they failed. People clearly did not want Proposition 13 if it meant the cutting back of services that they were accustomed to, you know, and so on. So I agree. I agree with you.
Part of the way to understand the kind of intervention into small and medium businesses that has been rejected is to see the economy as the Galbraith divides it between the planning economy and the market economy, where there are 500 or so of the largest corporations, say the Fortune 500, that are basically the planning economy that benefit the most from partnership with the government in all of the forms and interventions and regulations. And then there are some 10 to 12 million small companies that account for the other half of the gross national product that don't benefit so much from that, from the kinds of things that are involved in the planning of the economy.
Yeah.
And they're the ones that are carrying out the dog-eat-dog ways of their capitalism, while the large, the 500 that are accounting for the other half of GNP are cozy with the government and got it all figured out how they can work together and plan it out and reduce the risks like you're talking about.
I agree in part, you know, with that. And that's why I also say that, you know, that economic and political power or forces coexist in our economy in the present day. And as long as there is coexistence between economic and political forces, we will continue to have business civilization. It's only when the political force becomes dominant that we will tend to go more towards some kind of authoritarian type of government. But that too will become, because it will be necessary, I think. Yeah, go ahead, Brad.
So far we've been talking about a lot of management, corporate type things. How serious do you see the plight of the farmer in America? How seriously does that affect what we're talking about here? Are their straits really desperate? Certainly it's not a very secure profession, relatively speaking, 50 years ago. Is it getting so high priced and high cost that stability is just going to vanish?
Do you want my reaction? I don't think their plight is nearly what they sort of put it up to be. But, and we've had tremendous increases in productivity on the farms. And so efficient farms are able to manage. But I guess that's the point. Sometimes the size of the farm as a firm has to change in order to be able to take care of this efficiency. And I think that's probably the agricultural struggle that we are faced with, that the farms that will survive and the ones that will sort of be efficient enough to will be larger farms. And so it's almost as much a social struggle as it is an economic struggle. And then that creates sort of tremendous compositional changes within a large group of farmers drifting in through other forms of the labor market jobs and so on. But I don't...
Why do you think they're drifting into other forms of the labor market?
Because they can't efficiently...
Because they cannot make a living as a family farmer.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
We know. That's where we come from. And we're feeding the world, trying to feed the world.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, the world is growing faster than the individual family farmer can feed it in.
Most farmers where we come from, and we come from, an agriculture state, have to have other sources of income to survive, to live.
Yeah, two farmers or two farm families sitting right. All of you here?
Yeah.
I'm going to move over there.